the Triathlon Show 324. Hey, what's up everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Dr. Andy Kirkland. Andy is a triathlon coach, sports physiologist, and a lecturer in sports coaching at the University of Stirling. In this interview, Andy shares his perspectives on a number of topics related to coaching, from his experience as a coach educator, and as part of various high-performance environments. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration have a range of tools and products to help you personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so that you can perform at your best in racing and in training. The key variables you need to figure out when it comes to optimizing your fueling and hydration include your carbohydrate intake, your sweat rate, and your sweat sodium concentration. And Precision Fuel and Hydration have tools like the free online sweat test and the quick carb calculator to help you understand all of those and get a free strategy personalized to your numbers. You can then go even further and have a free one-to-one video consultation with the team at Precision Fuel and Hydration to get it really, really optimized and tuned to yourself as an individual. As a listener of the show, you also can get 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TTS22 at checkout at precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Indoor Swim Trainer is a swim bench that helps you improve your technique through optimizing your early catch. It helps you maximize propulsion for a more powerful stroke. And most importantly, it helps you stay consistent by doing swim workouts at home even when you can't go to the pool for either lack of time availability or pools being closed or etc. etc. The Zenate Swim Trainer is available in the UK, the EU and the US with free shipping within the UK and the US. And it is very affordable, similar to a pair of running shoes. And it's a completely risk-free investment, because if you're not in love with the Zenate Swim Trainer after 2 weeks of using it and using their free training program, you can send it back and get a full refund. Learn more and get a 20% discount on your Zenate Swim Trainer on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Dr. Andy Kirkland. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Andy. How are you doing?
Oh, good, Michael. Good. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I want you to start by just introducing yourself to the audience. Tell us a bit more about who you are and your background in coaching and also specifically your relation with triathlon.
All right. So I'll start off with triathlon. I've been involved in triathlon since probably the mid-1990s. As a decidedly average age group athlete who was absolutely obsessed. I did Ironman when very few people had done Ironman, and that really got me interested in becoming something professional in sport. So since that time, I've had quite a varied career. But recently I've coached a few professional triathletes. I've worked in a number of local clubs, been involved with national governing bodies. So there's a whole mix of things that I've done in triathlon. But simple to say that it's part of who I am. Being a triathlete and being involved in triathlon is part of who I am. And I still do a bit of swimming, biking and running, despite me getting on a bit now and being quite a bit slower than I used to be.
Yeah, so it's fair to say that triathlon is your main sport, would you say, that you have as an athlete or recreational athlete yourself, even though within coaching you have worked in many different domains than triathlon, as we'll get on to.
Yeah, so triathlon is my main sport. I came to in my first sport was cycling, in fact. Mm. But like many triathletes, there was no chance that I could handle a bike in a bunch. I would get dropped as soon as the bunch accelerated. and road racing wasn't really for me. And I did a 10K for fun and actually did it quite quickly, and then got dragged into a swimming pool by a triathlete who was a guy called Scott Balfour, in fact, multiple Kona finisher and sub 3 hour marathoner when he was over 60. So Scott's a legend of triathlon in Scotland, where I'm from. Scott dragged me into the sport and encouraged me to start swimming. I'll give you my starting point. My first 400 meter time trial, and I think week three of swimming, was 12 minutes and 3 seconds.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's one of the slower ones that I've heard of. Congratulations.
Yeah. So over 12 minutes to do 400 meters. I'll never forget. Yeah. So that was my starting point.
At least you could do it. I mean, there are plenty of people and all kudos to them for then getting to the point of completing an Ironman swim. But lots of people that can't swim 25 meters when they start out. So, so you could do the distance at least.
Yeah.
All right. So what about your the wider kind of your interest in coaching and the work that you do in coaching? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I think I have had an interesting journey in that when I came into the profession, I started off as a sports scientist working in high performance sport after doing quite a traditional journey, which we'll touch on a wee bit later.
Well, we can touch on the journey now, actually. So you studied exercise science and physiology, is that right?
So sports science, so biomechanics, yep, psychology, physiology, bit of coaching thrown in, but it was a real sports science orientated degree. I loved it so much that I went on to study a PhD relating to exercise intensity and cycling performance, so looking at fatigue and physiological basis of fatigue. So I did that for too many years. It was a slow process. After that, I went into the Scottish Institute of Sport to work on as a physiologist across a number of programs, including cycling, swimming, rugby, winter sports, multitude of different things, which was great on many levels. Not so much fun on other levels, a very challenging environment. And I'll definitely touch on that later and some of my beliefs around coaching and how coaches learn and so on. After that, I moved on to British Cycling, which was at the time one of the most successful governing bodies in the world. So that was a fun time in Manchester. Just being based in the velodrome and having friends in that environment was the key experience for me. And I was a coach developer and a coach educator in that environment. So writing courses, delivering courses, mentoring coaches and so on. And that brings me up to the present day, where I think I found my perfect job in that I'm a lecturer in sports coaching at the University of Stirling. And what I do really in my day job is work with professional level coaches from the grassroots up to the very highest level of sport. So we like to talk on the program that we've got someone from a Formula One motor racing team who works as head of coaching in a pit lane crew. So we've got a huge diversity from grassroots community coaches through to those on the very highest level performance programs in the world.
Mm, yeah. And so that's actually my next question was going to be around your role there and the program. So feel free to dive into a bit more detail around what the program is all about and also what your role within it is.
Well, my role is a traditional lecturer in that I'll deliver lectures, provide supervision and so on. But we've got not a unique group of coaches, but we've got such a diverse group of coaches that simply telling them what to do or what to know doesn't work, because what works for a football coach on an under nines program doesn't necessarily work on a performance program at Olympic level. So what we primarily do is challenge coaches to ask why they do what they do, to explore alternative ways of coaching, to consider how they evaluate their practice, and be really reflective on what they do. So I see my role as planting seeds, and planting lots of seeds and allowing the coaches to germinate the ones that are most meaningful to them. But it also means really pushing hard on them to challenge what I call the cultural status quo in how they coach in their environment. So as a triathlon coach, there's many commonalities throughout the world of how a triathlon coach would coach athletes, but it can be very different to maybe on a kayak program, a sprint kayak program, or a football program, or a skiing program. So people coach in different ways. So I really encourage others to explore different ways of coaching and not just to be like a sheep and follow the crowd and do what everyone else does in their own sport.
Yeah.
And, so that's a major...
I was going to say that sounds fantastic. I mean, that a lot of what coaching is about really is about being able to be reflective and think about your own process and improving your process and together with the athlete, taking one step at a time and getting gradually better at what you're doing in the context that you're working in. So it sounds like that's what you're doing rather than giving direct answers, which there aren't any, because as you say, contexts are so different. But I was going to ask, the sports coaching program, it's not something that I've heard that there exist that many of, but maybe I'm mistaken. I have just missed them. But is your program quite unique, or are there plenty of them around at different universities?
It's probably somewhere in the middle. So coaching programs are becoming more common, primarily at an undergraduate level. But many universities have master's programs too. I think what's almost unique about ours is that coaches can study from anywhere in the world. So it's a distance program. So we're not doing it face-to-face. So it means that, you say you're in
Lisbon.
Portugal.
Yep.
I had one coach a few years ago from Portugal, another who's up in the Alps, another in China, quite a few in Singapore. So it means that we bring that cultural mix in, which is a real strength. And we've got a really tight team, a teaching team. We actually like each other, which is great in a working environment. We like and respect each other. And we've got a cohesive program which looks at sporting performance and coaching performance from a number of different angles. But we focus on the same things primarily. Why are you doing what you're doing? And how does that understanding shape how effective you are as a coach? Are you making a difference, or are you just assimilating with those cultural status quos? So I think that's what's, well, the unique selling point of what we do is not setting strict constraints or a traditional coach education pathway where you do a number of modules in a number of areas and you're expected to repeat what the tutor's told you. It's nothing like that.
Yeah, no, that's how you create the status quo that you said exists in many areas, not how you encourage people to think about better ways to do things. So knowing this now, which I didn't know before when I created the questions, I'm going to adjust my next question a little bit. And basically, I want to ask you about pathways into coaching. And just generally, what are your thoughts around good pathways into coaching? If somebody's listening to this and maybe they're a high school student and they're interested in getting into coaching or wherever they might be in their career, what would you say are, if somebody is interested in that, are good pathways to getting into coaching, whether they're thinking about being a Premier League football coach or a professional triathlon coach or a grassroots level kayaking coach or something? What's your opinion on that?
It's a really great question, and like many really great questions, it's very difficult to answer because in the UK where I'm from and beyond, there's not clearly defined coaching pathways. So many coaches we see at the top level have got there from being good athletes before, whereas others take quite different pathways. And I was actually thinking about a chat I had with another triathlon coach a few years back, in fact. And we followed completely different pathways into coaching. So I was more academic, more high performance. He learned what he did through doing and practical experience and working it out as he went along. And what was really interesting about that was that we had reached very similar conclusions about what was needed to coach effectively and some of our beliefs around coaching. I would suggest, though, that the ideal is to do as much coaching as you can. So experience, it's a craft process. We learn, and most coaches learn through doing and interacting and learning from others. So the best way to learn about being a coach is to do the job and to work at multiple different levels if you can. Now, my first coaching job wasn't even a coaching job. It was a teaching job. It was teaching 3-year-olds how to swim. And that taught me a great deal about the basics of human emotions. For example, a 3-year-old isn't very good at controlling their emotions. When they get to about 4 or 5, they may be better at articulating themselves. But if you're not doing a very good job, a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old will disengage or tell you that it's boring or start misbehaving. So you very quickly decide what works and what doesn't. Working with very young children. I've also worked in community clubs and in high performance. And I think getting that diversity of experience in different areas and learning your trade really well is very important. What is really good about what I do in my day job is that I work with coaches who have bring experiences like that to the academic world, in which they've already got a pretty good understanding of what coaching means to them and what's involved in their job. And when they get to that stage, we can start to check and challenge their practices. And that way, the learning can be very rapid and the change can be very dramatic too. So I think a mix of practical experience and maybe a higher level degree is a good way about going through it, because at maybe undergraduate level, some of the learning isn't built upon experience. It may be more theory dependent. It's a combination of practical experience and being really inquisitive.
Yeah. So just to repeat that for the listeners, to make sure that they get the context, your program is a master's program, master's level program. And also, I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I checked the website, and I think it said that the students are expected to have 5 years of coaching experience under their belt when they start the program, or was that just that that's the average level, maybe not a requirement per se?
That's a rule of thumb. But important in terms of learning is pre-existing knowledge. So it may be that we've got someone who has transferred from a business environment, you know, they've done a normal job and decided, well, I really love sport and I want to leave the corporate world. So they may have been a senior manager in industry and bring with them lots of coaching skills that can be transferred into sport. So they may come with 2 years experience, but be able to demonstrate a deeper level of coaching practice, maybe in a different industry.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, so this is going to be another quite difficult question perhaps, but in terms of, again, looking at academic options, because I'm sure there are some listeners that are interested in hearing about that. Let's say you have somebody who is thinking about pursuing a master's degree in sports science or exercise physiology, but now they're thinking, maybe I would like to pursue my master's degree in sports coaching instead. What would you say are the pros and cons or scenarios in which one might be better than the other?
Oh, that's a really difficult question. And based on my reflections, thinking back to my experiences going through the sports science pathway, is that I developed some really great tools in my coaching in terms of needs analysis. So that's understanding the demands of the sport, being able to measure these demands, being able to prioritize them, and being able to decide what is an important measurement and what's not an important measurement. And thinking about things like, if we're doing a performance test, how does it relate to the sport? How do we use that data to influence the behavior of the performer and so on? And are we producing valid and reliable data to base our decisions on? So these are fundamental tools in my coaching toolbox. But also, there's a philosophical perspective in that learning within a sports science discipline teaches you to think perhaps in a more reductionist way. So looking at single causation. So in many of the listeners will be familiar with VO2 max as a measurement that you may use in sports science. But that's actually quite a complex number that takes nuance to apply effectively in a performance environment. So it's understanding how that measurement fits into the big picture and how you use the data to influence your coach decision-making is really important. And there's a deep philosophical basis to how we create knowledge surrounding things, whether it relates to science, social science, or how we understand the world.
Yeah.
So what's the answer to my question? Your question? I would say that the skills or an effective coach who understands sports science can probably operate autonomously from sports scientists most of the time, or if they want to engage with sports scientists, they can guide what they expect from the sports scientist. And what I mean by that was, many of the times when I was working in that performance environment, I would be expected to go and test a whole lot of things on a performance program. in my toolbox was lactate testing, VO2 max testing, efficiency testing. I would have my tools in my toolbox and I would apply many of them regardless of what the sport was. And most of the time, the coaches didn't know what I was talking about and let me get on with it without really understanding what I was doing, why I was doing it, and how to use what I was doing within what they did as a coach. So I would suggest that the key is what you choose to study is dependent on what you want to do. If you want to be a coach, probably come on a program like ours or do another coaching program. If you want to be a sports scientist, learn about sports science, but also key, and it's a really difficult one, is to consider the philosophical basis of science, how you create your knowledge, how it can be applied in the real world, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the approaches you're using. And many of the ways of doing that relate more to coaching and human interaction than they do to maybe the traditional sports science programs.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. And then moving on a bit from the whole academic pathways discussion, I want to pick your brains a little bit on some coaching related topics. And first of all, as we can already tell from some of the things that you've been saying here, I think it seems pretty clear that you're taking quite a holistic view to coaching. And I would like to ask you how you would describe that approach, and what are the different domains that you think a coach needs to have at least some knowledge in to be able to really be effective as a coach?
All right. So it's a really interesting question. And what coaching in my sphere is often described as being complex, dynamic, and ever-changing. Because coaching is influencing the behavior of others. It involves human interaction. And if we were to be having this discussion, say, on a medical podcast, for example, we might not be talking about holistic practice. We would talk about using a biopsychosocial framework. And that means exploring the interaction between biological and physiological processes, i.e. how the body works, mental processes and how humans think, and then social is the interaction between humans. So that holistic biopsychosocial perspective really means considering the bio, the psycho, and the social in all our coaching practices.
So we need to have some knowledge about all of those domains.
I would suggest that knowing more about behavior change, which is an area that I do in my research, is really important. So what we do as coaches is influence the behavior of others. If we're effective, and we influence their behavior positively if we're good at what we do. But there's very good science behind behavior change. And there's one really good model that explains different components. And for us to change the behavior of other people, we firstly must know what their capabilities are, both physical and mental. We must know what their opportunities for change are and what their motivations are. So before we even decide to do anything, understanding these capabilities, opportunities, and motivations is key in deciding how we want to interact with those individuals to help them be better performers. And that's guided by another area of science that hasn't really come into sport as of yet. So I think that's key, is that sometimes we focus on the performance enhancement, the physiological stuff, when in fact what we do is behavior change. And much of the practice of coaches on behavior change isn't guided by evidence, isn't guided by science. It's just made up as we go along. We talk about soft skills, but those soft skills can be very well described and developed through different scientific approaches that haven't come into sport very much. So that's a key area for me, is maybe recognizing how important social interactions and behavior change are in coaching practice, because that's what coaches do if they're good at what they do.
Yeah. If you have one example each of a good resource, relatively introductory resource you recommend to coaches on social interactions and behavioral change, for example, like a popular scientific book or something like that, do you have something like that? Would you be able to give one of each?
Well, I suppose some of these things could be summarized in the behavioral change wheel from Susan Meshey and others. So it can be summarized in a picture. I know sometimes as coaches, we like pictures and like things to be as simple as possible and not involve reading lots of things. The behavioral change wheel of Meshey et al. So that's M-I-C-H-I-E. And that's readily available on the internet. It is a really, really good resource to understand these things.
It's funny that you should talk about behavioral change, because actually this very morning, as we're recording this, we had a call with the other coaches in the Scientific Triathlon Coaching Group, and we were discussing what the things are that you can do when an athlete is not training consistently, when there's like periods of things maybe they are training consistently, but then it's always followed by periods of very inconsistent training or no training at all, and what you can do as a coach in that situation. I got to say we left that discussion, I think, with lots of questions and very few answers, but maybe we can find something in that, for example, in that wheel, or by digging deeper into the behavioral change sciences. So it's very, very timely that you should mention that.
No, I think so. I know you sent me other questions of how we can apply this to age groupers or whatever, how we coach age groupers. And when I'm working with athletes, what's key to me is their understanding what their capability, their understanding of performance is, what their performance behaviors are, and who they're influenced by. So I'm sure you'll have experienced this as well. You may be suggesting a particular way of training to an athlete, but they're working with in the context I've worked with, training with other professional athletes who are doing something really different. So that brings a doubt into the mind of the athletes. They challenge the coach, saying, is the coach right? Am I doing what's best for me? So it's where their beliefs are coming from and how they understand performance themselves is really important before we even start to say, my way is better. It may be that through discussing these things with athletes, as a coach, you get a greater insight into what they're doing, why they're doing it, and it may mean that we challenge our own ways of coaching. Or we may find a different way to coach the athlete. Another important thing is to recognize that humans aren't always logical or rational. They do daft things for unknown reasons. If we apply behavioral change to health, all we would need to do to stop smoking is to tell people to stop smoking, and they would, because everyone knows that smoking kills you and it's not good for your health and it makes you feel rubbish. So if we were to apply a traditional model of coaching, it would be, oh, right, I want you to stop smoking, and if you do, your performance will get better. That's all well and good, but there's other things at play that prevent people from stopping smoking. It's the same with saying, I want year, an athlete is training too hard, for example, consistently training too hard. So simply telling them to do less doesn't work. It rarely works. It may take months or even years to influence their behaviors so that they're not overtraining, for example. And there's deeper psychological reasons for them training in the way they do. And some of them aren't rational, and that takes time to explore and find out.
What might you, if you give some quick tips for, in that example of an athlete constantly training too hard, what might be some things that you would ask them, or you would tell them to help get past that problem? You can use me as a guinea pig. Let's say I'm your athlete and I'm constantly training too hard.
I would say along the lines of, I think that you are training too hard and we're not seeing the progression in your performance. Why is it you train in the way you do?
Well, this guy and that guy beat me in my last races, and they're training harder than I do. So if I'm going to beat them in the next race, then I need to train at least as hard as them, if not harder, if I'm going to be able to get faster than them.
So Michael, what evidence have you got to say that they are training harder than you?
I can see it on their Strava accounts.
Okay. And have you heard about the dose response to exercise?
No.
All right. So have you heard about the dose response to human growth hormone?
No.
All right. So how about a common medicine you might have in your medicine cabinet at home? So if you take a paracetamol for your headache, do you think that'll work?
Yes, quite often.
An instance that you might take for paracetamol?
No, I can't think of one. Right.
So why would that be?
I think that would be too much and possibly dangerous.
All right. So would you take 10 paracetamol in any case?
Definitely not. Definitely not.
All right. Because that would probably kill you, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
All right. So we've got a dose response to exercise as well. Is that when we start off taking something or doing exercise, the dose to result in change in their performance could be relatively low for us to get better. But as we progress and do more and more, we will subsequently or often need more of a dose of training to get better. But then there comes a time where sometimes you need that feeling to be doing more, to think you need that more to be better. But like a paracetamol, if you do more and more and more, it's likely to be damaging to your health. So we've got to find that individual dose response for you. And I would say that it's the minimum dose possible to maximize the physiological adaptation for you that really counts. So it doesn't matter what people are doing in your environment. I would suggest that most athletes overtrain anyway. Many only present their key workout sessions on Strava, ones they're proud about. What the pros do and what they talk about in the magazines are their hardest week ever in their lives, so that the reality between what others are doing and what you're doing, we don't really understand. Lots of what other athletes talk about them doing is bullshit. They're not actually doing that consistently. It's an ego thing. So what we need to do is find the right dose for you. There's two ways of doing that. First of all, is to trust in the coach. So I'll help you find that right dose. Or you can go and continue to train the way that you want to, and we'll monitor performance. And if you continue to get better and start winning things and beating these other athletes, then you've proved me wrong. But if you become injured, you break, or your performance isn't getting better, that poses the question, are you doing too much? Or do you actually think doing even more will result in the change you need to get better?
All right, you've given me a lot to think about. Maybe we'll try to scale it down a little bit, and I'll go a bit easier and see how things go.
But that process, I would often take 6 months to go through that process.
Yeah.
Sometimes allowing athletes to break, allowing them to go and do their own thing, to give them autonomy to make their own coaching decisions whilst giving guidance to say, well, I'm not so sure, I think you're doing too much, but if you think that's the best way, let's go with it and we'll see what happens. And more often than not, the athlete breaks or they don't get better, and then it comes back to me saying, well, I told you so, and me putting on that smug coaching face saying, well, I told you all along.
Well, that leads us to the next topic, which is a good coach-athlete relationship. You mentioned a couple of things that are already relating to that. But before we get there, was there anything else, any other area just that you want to list off that you think coaches should have a grasp of other than the ones we already talked about? And without going into detail, but if you have any one particular area that you want to list off that you think is often missed that coaches should investigate a little bit more?
Well, I'll bring it in. So there's a real biophysiological bias in triathlon, for example. So we focus on the physical development with maybe the development of VO2 max, lactate thresholds, and so on. I would suggest that through my study and understanding an area called oxygen uptake kinetics, so that's the dynamic response of oxygen uptake, which relates to VO2 max, gives us the underpinning knowledge behind training intensity. And what that study has taught me is that there's, or I certainly believe that there's not a need for strict adherence to training zones, and that a lot of the science and physiology is based on constant intensity, so a constant power output, a constant running pace. But in reality, we're out in the world dealing with hills, wind, all a different manner of things. So that understanding the underpinning physiology behind exercise intensity and not just accepting what's in most of the textbooks is a real key area for me. I think that underpins how I prescribe exercise intensity. It's not from textbooks, it's from a deep understanding of physiological responses during exercise, which is not necessarily reflected in most textbooks, but there's a few papers in oxygen uptake kinetics that really help with that.
So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're getting at there is that sometimes there is a false precision to adhering strictly to a training zone or a power target or some target, pace target or something like that. And in the real world, it's almost impossible to have that level of precision when you understand what's going on under the hood. Is that what you're describing there?
Yes, we're dealing with complex systems that athletes feel different from day to day. Heart rate responses are different from day to day. Substrate utilization, so whether we're using carbs or fat, the proportion is different from day to day, dependent on the interaction of lots of different things. So because of that, noise, precision, I don't believe is that important. And there's good science that explains why that's the case.
Yeah, and that's the oxygen kinetics that you, and I know you have an article, I think, was it on Training Peaks or on your website? I did skim through it a little bit, but basically where you explain that, yeah, variations in power output and so on will lead to basically, well, you're filling the gap of energy with, for example, anaerobic sources when, even when you're technically in an aerobic training zone and so on. So is that the gist of the physiological underpinning of what you're saying?
That's exactly it. Yeah. In that there's no such thing as aerobic intensity or anaerobic intensity. Both systems are switched on all the time.
So So how do you prescribe workouts for your athletes?
In a multitude of different ways, depending on what the purpose of the session is. And it could go simply based on pace. So I've recently been working with a pro athlete, and we know what sort of times they need to do in particular events. I would know what power output is required and what running pace and what swimming pace is required to achieve these demands. So prescription will relate to the demands of the event. So race pace, Ironman race pace, for example, we would be setting power outputs based on what would need to be sustainable for 5 hours, for example.
Yep.
Or the pace it takes to run a marathon. So we would use race pace as a starting point and bring it up or bring it down depending on what we want to achieve through the session. So that's one way. The other is rating of perceived exertion. I'll usually say on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being easy and 10 being as hard as you've ever gone before, we can use that. It doesn't need to be difficult. Mm-hmm. But I would rarely say, for example, this is a VO2 max session, because first of all, we wouldn't be measuring VO2 max in that session. And secondly, we don't know whether, or is a VO2 max session is very different depending on what age and stage of development you're at in the performance pathway, how long you've been training, and so on. So that terminology, knowing the underpinning science, doesn't make sense to me.
Mm, yeah, got it. And that all makes sense to me. Then moving on to discussing the coach-athlete relationship, what do you think are the attributes that are needed for to have a good coach-athlete relationship, and also what attributes do the coach and the athlete need to have for that to be a possibility?
It's a really good question, and I would liken it to probably, it would be good having some sort of coach-athlete dating site. Not that I'm advocating dating athletes, but it's how would you select a partner, for example, someone that you want a long-term relationship with? And firstly, you've got to like them. You've got to be able to engage and like a person. And for the relationship to be lasting, you need openness, integrity, trust. These things that determine effective relationships. And it is openness, integrity, respect for each other are absolutely key. I would say from my coaching perspective as well, and I'm not coaching so much now, but my time's very valuable to me, so that if I'm going to spend 4 hours on my Sunday prescribing training for someone, I'm not bothered about the money. I really need to like them and want them to succeed, and I need to want to give up my time away from my own partner to help someone else. So that level of respect is needed too. And what else was I thinking about? I'm just checking my notes, Michael, because I've forgotten about the other bit that I had.
Yeah, that's fine.
Let's see. I can't find it now, so it's completely gone out of my head, but it'll come back to me.
Well, I do think that some smart listener is already working on that coach athlete, not dating, but find each other app that you suggested. That's probably a business idea.
I've just remembered it. And this might sound absolutely ridiculous, but for a coach, I think it's absolutely critical to like people, to like other human beings. And that may sound daft, but having worked in a number of performance environments, I've seen coaches who obviously don't like human beings. They're not very nice to them in many cases. Seen it quite prevalent in swimming, for example. So you need to like people. Mm. I absolutely love people, engaging with people, and I want to help them achieve their potential. Simple. That's what drives me to be a coach, is helping others reach their potential.
Yeah.
And it's about dropping my ego as well. It's not about me. It's about helping others.
Mm. Do you have any, when an athlete is interested in starting working with you as a coach, are there any questions that you ask the athlete that you need to know from the athlete, to information that you basically need to know about them, or like to ask them their opinion of, or how they are as a personality, for you to know that, okay, this is likely to be a good relationship, or this is probably not going to be such a good relationship?
Well, I'll certainly not take someone on overnight. Usually suggest that we'll have a few weeks of speaking to each other, having a few meetings, chatting about stuff, building rapport and trust. Because in an initial meeting, you're getting to know someone. Athletes may want to tell me how good they are and how great at training they'll be and how they want to be world champion. But it takes time for me to understand whether they're being realistic and whether they've got the capability of doing these things too. So my process is typically a trial period of a few months, seeing what training they've previously been doing, how good they are at giving feedback, how good the interactions are in their chats, lots of different things. And then over that period, I would build up a picture of strengths and weaknesses in that athlete. And invariably, at the end of the process, we would decide together whether we wanted to work together or not. It's got to be a mutual process in which we both consent to work with each other. I will walk away from someone, not even entertain a discussion, unless I see evidence that they've done their homework, that they've spoken to other coaches. Because you wouldn't just go on an internet dating site and pick the first person you saw a picture that you quite liked, or someone with the best CV to build a long-lasting relationship. You would want to check what the options are, and that's what I would expect as a coach from prospective athletes, that they explore their options.
Yeah. And from a coach's perspective, other than actually having to like people and some of the other things we already mentioned, is there anything else, if you have one final tip that you could give for being able to form good coach-athlete relationships to coaches, what would that be?
Don't be a dick. That's quite a blunt one, but don't be a dick. It is about being...
Do you think is it that prominent in coaching that coaches are being dicks?
What do you think?
Well, I'm lucky enough to mostly know really great coaches, so maybe I'm blissfully ignorant of it. But no, I know what you're getting at. Of course, there is a lot of it going on in the industry. So
yeah. I think that's a great rule of life.
All right. Well, then let me see here. And then just, we already talked a bit about physiology, so I'm going to skip that question that is the next on our list, and jump straight to, other than this, general tips for coaches on how they can improve their coaching practices and increase their quote-unquote expertise as coaches. And this can be direct tips to directly improve their practice, or it can also be tips for how they can develop themselves as coaches, or anything of that nature. Do you have any things that you would like to share on that?
I would say look for inspiration in everything you do. So I learn lots about my own coaching practice through engaging with the arts. And so going to art exhibitions, going to presentations and so on, and looking for things that I can apply to understand the world and people that operate within it more effectively. I also told you at the beginning that the new puppy may interrupt, and fortunately she's not, but I'm learning so much about coaching from trying to teach a puppy how to do stuff. So it's getting inspiration from things like that. So I can say sit in 5-6 different ways, and the puppy will only respond if I say sit in the tone that it understands. So I'm learning about coaching from trying to teach a puppy the basics, the importance of tone of voice, the importance of eye contact, the importance of posture, at a level that probably going on a coaching course would never teach me. If I get it wrong, the puppy will bite me or pee in the corner or just not listen at all. So it's to look at for inspiration in absolutely everything you do and everything you engage within. And don't be constrained by reading every book about triathlon, for example. It's useful to read one or two, but after a while, a lot are repetitive. Look for new things. Be open-minded. Don't look for simple top tips to be better. It's just be open-minded and engaged with the world.
That's really great. And as you said at the beginning, challenge the status quo. And to do that, obviously, you need to be open-minded and open to new ideas, not just ideas that you get but from somebody, but that you create yourself by how you engage with the world. So that's really good. What about tips for athletes? Now I'm going to ask you for tips, even though you said that you shouldn't be looking for tips, but I'm going to do it anyway. So just some piece of advice for age group triathletes that want to improve their performance. What would you tell them?
So first of all, I would, same for coaches, in fact, is to ask yourself the question, why are you following the approach you're following? Is that the best way? And what are the alternatives? The second one is never to, this is typical me, but never to accept things on face value. Be very careful in trusting sources of information about training. And thirdly, be challenging and continue to ask questions. Just ask questions of people all the time and make up your mind for yourself. For most age group athletes, I think continuing to enjoy the sport, recognizing that it's not about life and death, it's about enjoyment. And unless you're going to be a world champion, think about other things in life too. In fact, even if you want to be world champion, other things in life are really important. Sport isn't everything. Just consistently enjoy what you do. And when you're not enjoying it, look for different ways of training to retain that joy. I still train. I still love training. And I'm continually thinking of different ways of doing it to keep me engaged, 30-odd years later after I started. Mm.
Do you have any examples of just some things that you've done, how you've changed up your training a bit just for the sake of enjoyment at some point over these 30 years, like some things that you've maybe taken up for a period to keep things fun and engaging when you've been just bored of the typical stuff?
Yeah, first of all, is that I can't remember the last time I was in a swimming pool. So it's doing all my swimming open water and finding different environments and being excited if I see a jellyfish or a starfish, being able to going out in big waves, going out in challenging conditions. It just brings so much excitement. Also limiters to that as well, i.e. swimming too slow too often. But doing things in different environments for me is key. I know you're going to ask a question about a great resource or something to read. And I took great inspiration from a book by Michael Crawley, and it's called Out of Thin Air. In that book, Michael, I met him a couple of years ago just before I went to Kenya, in fact. So I was going up to the Rift Valley to do some research on Kenyan runners. And I read an article in a newspaper by Michael, who had been exploring runners in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa. So Michael helped me quite a bit in doing some of the work I did in Kenya. And he was doing a PhD in anthropology on Ethiopian runners at the time. And then he wrote a book, Out of Thin Air. It's an amazing book. And he talked about how the Ethiopians use their environments. They use their GPSs in different ways. So the GPS isn't to hit a pace. It's to run. They often use their GPS to run as slowly as possible. They don't necessarily use paths when they go out running. They'll follow the environment which is best for their training. So that's influenced me as well, is going out on a run instead of the out and back 15 kilometers at, say, 5 minutes per kilometer pace, something like that. It's meant running in a park, running around trees, running through mud, doing different things on that long run in different environments, and taking my camera with me. I do photography, so stopping if I wanted to take a picture. And it's just a different way of training. But if we look at maybe Ethiopian running performances, they're pretty handy at what they do. It's just a different way of thinking about how to construct a training session.
Yeah. Michael Crawley was on the podcast, and I read his book, and yeah, I agree, it's great. And we talked about that, so I'll link to it in the show notes for the listeners if they've missed it. But yeah, really agree with all of that. That's great. Then, is there any one thing that you're currently really interested in and learning more about as a coach or a coach educator? So can you tell us about one thing that keeps you busy with learning and fascination at the moment?
Oh, one thing that's really difficult. I've already spoken about getting a puppy and how that influences what I do, but it's learning about how to coach a different creature. most, it's funny, in my world, I'm constantly reading things as part of my job, as part of my research. So that continuous professional development just happens. Hmm. It happens through conversations with other coaches too. So it's really not intentional. I would say where I learn more about things is maybe in my photography. I do a lot of photography, and learning how to do that, how to use the technology, how to frame things, how to interpret your environment. I would use that. Some of these skills are directly transferable into coaching. I use an example. I went to watch some whitewater kayaking with a coach. And through my photography and framing different segments of the course and looking at performance at different levels really meant I could engage in a sport that I didn't have a clue about and demonstrate a deep understanding of a sport that I had no experience of through photography, just framing shots and understanding these snapshots and asking questions. So I've not got that one. It's again, it comes back to being open, find inspiration in everything.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine, and I think that's maybe maybe the title of the episode, or at least the main takeaway is being open minded and finding inspiration around you and learning from engaging with the world in different ways. So that's really great. And then finally, let's do the rapid fire question. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one, maybe you've already answered that, but in that case, just repeat it. What is your favorite book or resource?
Yeah, right now it is Michael Crawley, Out of Thin Air.
All right. And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Getting a life and doing things away from sport intentionally.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I've got three people in triathlon. One is Darren Smith, who you may have heard of.
Yep. Yeah.
The second you definitely have heard of, David Tilbury Davis, who's quite an eminent coach and a really good friend as well. And someone everyone will have heard of is Chrissy Wellington. So I've had quite a lot of interaction with Chrissy over the last few years, and I've got such a deep respect for that woman away from our triathlon performances. So Chrissy's just an incredible human being.
Yeah, I don't know her, but I did read her book as well, her autobiography, and I think it's still one of the best sort of autobiographies in general that I've read, but definitely in terms of triathlon, it's just an inspirational book, if anything. And she actually exemplifies a lot of the things that you've been talking about with how she got into triathlon from a very different background, doing things like the mountain bike trekking in Nepal and all of those sorts of things, and then to come back and be really competitive in races off of just that, those sort of long bike rides in Nepal. It's been a while since I read it, but fantastic book, and of course, yeah, everybody knows Chrissy Wellington, legend of the sport.
Well, I actually got to know her through helping her write her second book, the more coaching orientated one. So I helped with a few chapters, and it was quite a process in that Chrissy never takes no for an answer or asks, why have you written that instead of this? Are you sure you're right? She's absolutely relentless in her quest for perfection. And then I was reviewing stuff written by other people as well and having to carefully provide feedback to suggest there's some problems there. But it's just the humility these interactions were in. It's just such a great person to work with, but also really challenging, someone that pushes you to your absolute max, and you just can't be complacent with someone like Chrissy. So yeah, she's a complete inspiration, and it's nothing to do with how fast she's able to do an Ironman.
Mm, yeah. Well, finally, Andy, where can people follow you? And if they want to reach out to you or learn more about the program at the coaching program at the University of Stirling, can you give us some information around that?
Right, really easy. So in terms of following me, I'm quite active on Twitter. So it's Andy Kirkland 71. I'm giving away my age there on Twitter. And it's very easy to find out a little bit about the coaching program on the University of Stirling website. So all you need to do is Google Performance Coaching MSc, University of Stirling, and it'll take you to the page. And it's really easy to find me as well. So if any of the listeners have got any questions about the program, drop me an email. If you're seriously considering coming on it, then I'm more than happy to spend time discussing more about the program.
Yeah, and as you mentioned already, it is a remote learning program, so open to people from all over the world. You're a good follower on Twitter, so definitely I encourage people to follow you. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast and share your views on coaching. It's been really, really insightful, and I appreciate all of the wisdom that you've shared, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks very much, Michael. Pleasure.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to Andy's website, Twitter, and university profiles. Also, some episodes and books we mentioned, including interviews that I've done with Michael Crawley and Mark Burnley, will be linked there, and the books by Michael Crawley and Chrissy Wellington that we talked about as well. If you're looking to take your triathlon to the next level, then consider getting a coach or getting a training plan. We have both options available on scientifictriathlon.com, so go and have a look there and see if it is for you. Also, I'm happy to answer questions that you might have if you need further details. Just email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. Next Monday on the podcast, we have Dr. Marco Altini back on the show with new science and up-to-date best practices regarding heart rate variability, HRV, as our topic. So that will be really interesting. Make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast so you don't miss anything and can get the show as it is released every Monday. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free online sweat test and their quick carb calculator to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and individualize your plan. And book a free video consultation with the team to refine your strategy. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Zen8. Use the Zen8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and most importantly, your swim training consistency. Get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with a promo code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. And don't forget that it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.